Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Stephen Welsh on behalf of Appellant Wilmer Milton. Mr. Milton was convicted on March 19, 2012 of one count of attempted murder, three counts of possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, one count of robbery in the first degree, one count of burglary in the first degree, one count of wearing a disguise during the commission of a felony, and one count of conspiracy in the second degree. He filed a timely appeal, and now there's three issues before the Court today on appeal. Those issues are, one, did the Court err in denying the motion for a directed verdict? Two, were the three unrecorded sidebars done inappropriately in violation of Criminal Rules of Civil Procedure 26.1? And three, did the trial court err in sustaining the state's objection on relevancy grounds? If it pleases the Court, a brief recitation of facts as they were presented at the time of trial. On March 21st, 2011, Sean Blackwell was home in his apartment with friend Adrian Bennett doing cocaine. Ms. Bennett left almost immediately after she left. Four individuals entered the residence for the purpose of robbing Mr. Blackwell. During the course of this robbery, Mr. Blackwell was shot in the back. Mr. Blackwell testified at trial that he could not identify visually any of the co-defendants, nor defendant Wilmer Milton. However, he verbally knew the voice of co-defendant Ronald Roundtree. Mr. Blackwell testified that Roundtree had a gun, that Roundtree pistol whipped him in the face, and immediately after being pistol whipped in the face, he was shot in the back by an unknown assailant at that time.
Well, he also explained that the person behind him with the gun said, if you don't move or I will blow your head off.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Blackwell did testify that there was threats made by the, at that time, unknown assailant standing behind him.
That's a threat to kill, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The three co-defendants testified at trial as well, Ronald Roundtree, Tremont Atkins, and Daryl Trotter. All three co-defendants testified differently as to the facts as they happened that night, and specifically as to who had a gun at the time. Tremont Atkins testified as to the order in which the co-defendants entered the home, that Wilmer Milton was first, followed by Roundtree, then Atkins, then Trotter. Roundtree testified that Milton entered first, followed by Atkins, then Trotter, then Roundtree. And Trotter testified that Milton entered first, followed by Atkins, then Roundtree, then Trotter. This in and of itself is a minor inconsistency. However, there's additional inconsistencies in their testimony. Tremont Atkins testified that there was only one gun during the course of the robbery. He testified that gun was in the possession of co-defendant Ronald Roundtree. This is consistent, at least with Roundtree having a gun, with what Blackwell, the victim, testified, that he recognized Roundtree's voice, that Roundtree pistol-whipped him, and that he had a gun, obviously, when he pistol-whipped him. Ronald Roundtree testified that there was two guns involved in the robbery, one in the possession of Tremont Atkins, one in the possession of defendant Wilmer Milton. Roundtree testified that he, in fact, did not have a gun at the time, contradictory to what Blackwell's testimony was. Trotter testified that there were two guns, one in the possession of Atkins, one in the possession of Milton. This is contradictory to victim Blackwell's testimony, as well as previously stated, the contradictory nature of how they entered the residence between Roundtree and Atkins. The jury, as I stated previously, convicted the defendant, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment plus 25 years. If it pleases the Court, I'll address the three issues as I address them in the brief in that order. The first issue, did the Court err in denying the motion for a directed verdict? It's the defendant's position that, based on the inconsistency of the testimony, no rational trier of fact could have found that Wilmer Milton, in fact, had the intent to kill. The basis behind this argument is that there's three theories that the state produced through the testimony provided at trial. The first theory is that of Blackwell's, that Roundtree had a gun, that Roundtree hit him in the face. Immediately after Roundtree hit him in the face, an unknown assailant, according to Blackwell, shot him in the back. The testimony, I believe, was that Blackwell didn't even know, he believed that Roundtree had shot him when the event actually occurred. It didn't occur to him till later, when it was explained by the paramedic that he was shot in the back, that he realized that the person standing behind him actually shot him.
Now, when there's references to being shot in the back, upper back, Is there any more specificity than that?
Where
the bullet entered the body? Did it go all the way through the body?
It did go through the body, Your Honor, and I believe the testimony from Mr. Blackwell was that he was partially paralyzed from, I believe, the chest down.
So it hit the spine?
Yes, went through the spine. It's my understanding, Your Honor, based on the testimony. The second theory, let me step back to the first theory, based on Blackwell's testimony. Under that testimony, Blackwell doesn't know who shot him in the back. He can't identify Milton. He knows that somebody was standing behind him, and he was shot in the back at the same time he was hit in the face by a gun by Roundtree. Then we have Roundtree and Atkins' version of events. Roundtree and Atkins both put two guns at the scene. Roundtree and Trotter. They both put two guns at the scene, one gun in the possession of Tremont Atkins and one gun in the possession of Wilmer Milton. If the jury were, or the trier fact were to believe this version of events, they would have to discount Blackwell's testimony about Roundtree having a gun, because both Trotter and Roundtree's testimony is clear that Roundtree does not have a gun. Trotter testifies that he doesn't see the shooting occur. Roundtree testifies that he does see the shooting occur, but once again, his testimony is contradictory as to how the events occurred to that of victim Blackwell. The last theory that a trier of fact could come to from the version of events as they were testified to is that of Tremont Atkins. Mr. Atkins testified that there was only one gun involved in the robbery, and that was of Ronald Roundtree. It's clear based on the evidence presented that there's sufficient evidence to prove that Mr. Milton was there. That's undisputed, and that he took part in the robbery. All three co-defendants testified that he's there. What I believe, or what defendant's position is that the state, or no rational trier of fact, could find based on any one of these three theories that Mr. Milton was the shooter and or that Mr. Milton had the intent to kill. If you believe the theory put forward by Trotter and Roundtree, you have to discount Blackwell. If you believe Blackwell's story, then you have to discount Roundtree and Trotter. And if you believe Atkins, then Mr. Milton doesn't even have a gun at the time the robbery occurs. It's important to remember in this case that there was no physical evidence.
Do you agree that the evidence does support an inference of an intentional shooting in the spine by the shooter?
I think whatever the evidence shows as to who was the shooter, putting that aside, the person that was standing behind the victim, in this case Blackwell, I think there is sufficient evidence to send the case to the jury and not through a directed verdict to show that there was intent to kill. I do believe there's sufficient evidence to show that based on just Blackwell's testimony. In the light most favorable to the state, if the jury believed Blackwell, then the man standing behind him threatened him and then shot him through the spine. I think that's sufficient to send it to the jury and not issue an order for a directed verdict on the singular count of attempted murder. However, I don't believe there's any one theory that puts Wilmer Milton behind Mr. Blackwell as the shooter. You have to take portions of each theory and put them together in order to get the evidence to show that Milton was, in fact, behind Blackwell. Blackwell can't put him there. Roundtree does put him there, but in order to believe Roundtree, you have to discount Blackwell's account because they directly contradict each other as to whether Roundtree had a gun, whether he pistol-whipped him at the time. Trotter.
Isn't that something the jury is allowed to do?
Yes, Your Honor. In a normal circumstance, a rational trier of fact, I believe, could make that determination. I think in this case, with so many contradictory stories of how the events occurred, I don't necessarily know that it would be appropriate to send that to a jury for that question. With three separate co-defendants in one major way, in how many guns were involved, having two different stories, and then in minor ways as to how they entered and what occurred while they were there, and those accounts differing greatly from the account of the victim, I don't necessarily know that a rational trier of fact could find, based on those three theories, that Wilmer Milton committed the crime of attempted murder. it pleases the court, I'll move on to the second issue that's before Your Honor for appeal. During the course of the trial, there were three unrecorded sidebar conferences in violation of Rule 26.1. At the conclusion of the questioning of witness Lee Daniels, which was the state's witness, there was a request for a sidebar.
Who made the request?
The request was made by defense counsel, Your Honor. And just to clarify to the court, I don't know if you're aware, I'm substitute counsel. I was not trial counsel at the time of the trial. But trial counsel asked for a sidebar, and I believe, based on the record, it was for an unrecorded sidebar. There is no reference after this unrecorded sidebar as to the nature of it. There wasn't a scheduling order done. There wasn't a break. So there was no objective information in the record to show what the nature of the sidebar was or what its purpose was.
I understand that, but don't you have a dilemma in that it was defense counsel who asked for the unreported sidebar, got it, and now complains about it?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there is a dilemma there. My reading of the case law is that if there wasn't an objection at the time, then the defense has to show prejudice. I think that same burden would apply here where defense counsel is requesting the unrecorded sidebar, that there need to be a showing of prejudice. Now, the difficulty with that is that without a record and with substitute counsel.
Was there any attempt to get an affidavit to present as part of the appendix for us on appeal?
Your Honor, I considered that, and maybe inappropriately, I wasn't sure whether that would be appropriate to present on appeal.
A rule that says if something's not recorded, the two attorneys that were involved and the judge can enter into a stipulation that basically reconstructs the record. So that would have been an option for you in this case to have trial counsel for the defense and the prosecutor and the judge stipulate to what was said.
Yes, Your Honor, and perhaps that was a mistake on my part, not submitting an affidavit in order to attempt to show.
You can't do it with an affidavit because you're trying to get something in the record that you will purport to be reversible error. So the rule provides you have to have a stipulation to what occurred at the sidebar by the lawyers. Then the trial judge has to agree that's an accurate rendition of what happened. And then that becomes the record, and you can argue that on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. And that obviously was not done in this case.
Yeah, and I mentioned affidavit because the first thing you want to know is what defense counsel will say happened.
Correct,
before you
Your
take
Honor.
The next step to reconcile it with what the prosecutor says, because then you know whether there's any substance to it or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it may have been a request to turn the air conditioning on.
Yes, Your Honor.
And one I'd like to make right now. It could have been something innocuous like that.
Yes, Your Honor. And I have spoken with trial counsel about what he believes the nature of the off-the-record sidebar was. But obviously, I didn't take the steps of going further in accordance with the rule to provide a stipulation that could be argued on appeal. There was a second off-the-record sidebar that took place during the course of state's witness Adrian Bennett's cross-examination. Once again,
who requested it?
Defense counsel requested it, Your Honor. Defense counsel requested the off-the-record sidebar. The off-the-record sidebar took place. Immediately after the off-the-record sidebar, cross-examination continued of state's witness Adrian Bennett. Once again, there was no explanation. There was no scheduling order that was put in place immediately thereafter, and no break. At the conclusion of Ms. Bennett's testimony, there was an off-the-record sidebar again. This time, I believe it was at the court's requesting. The sidebar took place immediately thereafter the sidebar. There was an order given to the jury about scheduling, when the break would take place. However, it's not clear from the record that that was the nature of the sidebar. Because there is no record, I couldn't tell you what happened at sidebar. And without a clear record, I believe Mr. Milton has a problem in order to make an appropriate appeal through substitute counsel. It's difficult to perfect that appeal, and it's difficult to bring that appeal without a complete record for the court and for his counsel.
So what is your position, that because of the off-the-record sidebar, we must presume prejudice and reverse for a new trial?
Your Honor, defense is in a dilemma as to the first two off-the-record sidebar, as stated. Defense counsel requested it, and based on my review of the case law, then there has to be showing of prejudice. Our position is that there's inherent prejudice, and this is the reason for Rule 26.1. Without a complete record in a circumstance that occurs, as did in this case, when you then have substitute counsel being involved, we're talking about a trial that took place over a year ago at this point, trying to recreate the record becomes very difficult, and trying to prove prejudice is extremely difficult.
So are you asking us to presume prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm asking the court.
And is that a new rule?
It would be, yes, Your Honor. It would be a change from the present case law in presuming prejudice.
So, how does that argument relate to our existing rule that gives pretty clear instructions on how to reconstruct the record? If your rule prevails, then people don't even have to try to reconstruct the record in the future. They can simply capitalize on an omission in the record and say that constitutes reversible error?
I think Your Honor's analysis is correct. However, I think it would reinforce Rule 26.1. In presuming prejudice, it would ensure, at least in my opinion, that Rule 26.1 is followed every time, and that there would be no off-the-record sidebars during the course of trial, as is essentially.
Now, we've been discussing off-the-record sidebars since the Bailey case in the mid-'80s. There are a lot of those, and one of the things we talked about is that, you know, reversing a conviction is an option, but there are other alternatives about dealing with, you know, the people who participated in the unreported sidebar to make sure they don't do it again without reversing the conviction.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're in your rebuttal time. Do you want to get to the third issue, or do you want to wait?
I'll address the third issue, and I'll try to do it as briefly as possible, Your Honor. The third issue that's brought by Mr. Milton is the trial court erred in sustaining the state's relevancy objection. Essentially, what occurred was a state had a witness testifying, Ms. Coleman. This is Mr. Blackwell, the victim's paramour, whom Mr. Blackwell was living with at the time of the robbery. Ms. Coleman was questioned on cross-examination about a prior robbery that took place in 2011. Ms. Coleman answered that she didn't recall one. There was a follow-up question that was asked by defense counsel about a robbery that took place in March of 2011, prior to the robbery that they were in trial for at the time. There was an objection by the state on relevancy grounds. That objection was sustained. Defendant argues that that objection was sustained inappropriately, and the reason being that Deshaun Blackwell testified during the course of his testimony that he had never been robbed in 2011. It goes to the credibility of Deshaun Blackwell. If defense counsel would have been able to further question the witness, it's very possible, if not probable, that Ms. Coleman was likely to testify about whether this robbery occurred or not. If Ms. Coleman confirmed defense counsel's theory that there had been a previous robbery, it would have directly contradicted Mr. Blackwell's testimony, calling into credibility his entire testimony, or at the very least his recollection of the events that happened in the spring of 2011.
What was the basis of the trial judge's ruling to sustain the objection?
His basis of the ruling was that it was irrelevant, and that it would go potentially to confuse the jury with.
So both 401 and 403?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what's the error in a 403 analysis? To have everyone have witnesses come in about another robbery that's unrelated?
Your Honor, the error in that is that this was a very narrow line of questioning. It wasn't done to call into question this previous robbery or to follow a theory that somebody else robbed the defendant. The purpose of this questioning was to impeach Mr. Blackwell and Mr. Blackwell's previous statement that he hadn't been robbed. And it goes directly to the credibility of the victim in the case, Mr. Blackwell.
Do you know, as a matter of fact, based on your investigation, that the answer would have been in effect, yes, Mr. Blackwell was incorrect. There was indeed a prior robbery, and I, on the date indicated, and I can confirm that, or words to that effect?
Your Honor,
or would it have been, I don't remember, I don't know.
Your Honor, I've run out of time. With permission of the court to answer.
You're never out of time if you're answering my question.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding from defense counsel is, previous defense counsel, was that he had reason to believe that this robbery took place and had reason to believe that Ms. Coleman would answer in the affirmative that this did take place.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Abby Adams on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honors, none of defendants' claims have merit. There was ample evidence that Milton attempted to intentionally cause Blackwell's death, especially when viewed in the light most favorable to the State. Second, for the first two question sidebars, Milton's trial counsel specifically requested them without the court reporter, and Milton's speculative argument has not established prejudice or plain error. For the third sidebar, Mr. Milton, or defense counsel, admits in the brief that there's no basis for the claim because it was a scheduling matter that was described later on the record. For the third claim, the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in limiting cross-examination of the victim's girlfriend about a purported prior robbery that was irrelevant and would have confused the issue the jury was there to decide. To be more specific on the first claim, in the light most favorable to the State, there was ample evidence that Milton intentionally attempted to cause Blackwell's death. Three co-defendants identified him as the shooter. Milton admitted to Trotter in the car on the way to Dover that he had shot the victim, and there was a prison informant who testified that he overheard Milton admit that he shot the victim. The shooter, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, warned him, the victim, that he would blow his head off. He repeatedly threatened to kill him while standing behind him with the gun. The victim was shot in the middle upper back from point-blank range while on his knees with his hands behind his head. And other witnesses and photographic testimony put Milton with the co-defendants on the night of the shooting, both on the way to Blackwell's apartment to rob him and afterwards at the Royal Farms in Ellendale. Viewing all of the facts in the light most favorable to the State, there is ample evidence to prove that Milton committed a substantial step towards intentional murder. The three theories that defense has been relying on, it's misplaced for him to rely on those theories because the court views the evidence in the light most favorable to the State. And I believe, if I heard correctly, defense counsel just conceded that if you look at Blackwell's testimony as the victim, there was sufficient evidence for the attempted first-degree murder charge to go to the jury. As to the second argument, it also has no merit. The three unreported sidebars provide no basis for reversal because the defendant has not shown any cognizable prejudice. He's not established that the unrecorded sidebars deprived him of a meaningful appellate review or effective assistance of counsel on any argument at claim an issue, on any argument in issue on appeal. The first two sidebars, defense counsel specifically requested be held without the court reporter. Defense counsel knows Rule 26.1 in this court's prior cases and presumably would not have requested a sidebar without the court reporter if it was a substantive matter.
Well, if defense counsel knew about the rule, didn't the trial judge and the prosecutor know about the rule?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's reasonable for the trial judge to rely on the defense counsel requesting the sidebar without the court reporter in determining whether or not it was going to be a substantive sidebar. And there are other instances in the record where a non-substantive sidebar, or I believe there's at least one instance where the trial court summarized a prior discussion in chambers on the record when they first went into court on the first day. It's reasonable to believe from the record that had those sidebars been substantive, the trial judge would have summarized them when they went back on the record. And further, the state apologizes for not pursuing the rule that Justice Holland points out, finding a stipulation between the trial judge and the two attorneys, although I don't believe that was the state's duty to do in this case. I agree that it would have been helpful. The prosecutor, seated at state's table, has been consulted and reviewed the record and has stated to me that he has no recollection of what happened in those first two sidebars.
That he has no recollection?
Right. As for the third sidebar, the prosecutor requested a sidebar on scheduling, but he did not specifically request that it be held without the court reporter. He just said for scheduling. They went off the record, and when they came back on the record, it was clear, and I think defense counsel has conceded this in the opening brief, it's clear that that was a scheduling, non-substantive sidebar, because when they came back on the record, the trial court described a scheduling issue with witnesses and adjourned early for lunch, I believe it was early, for lunch, saying that the witnesses would not be available until 1:30, and the jury was to report back then. As it's been pointed out, Milton cannot have it both ways. His defense counsel cannot affirmatively request a sidebar without the court reporter and then turn around on appeal and argue that he was prejudiced and his case should be reversed. Finally, with respect to the trial court's limiting the cross-examination of the defendant's girlfriend, the Superior Court judge did not abuse its discretion in determining that that was irrelevant testimony that would have confused the issue. The jury was there to decide about the rock.
I'd like to ask you a question about the sidebars. Should this court give any further guidance to trial judges with a request for an unrecorded sidebar to perhaps at least say the unrecorded sidebar related to non-substantive issue for the trial judge to put something on the record so we're not later guessing as to what happened? Or should we just leave the law as it is?
Well, the court has spoken loudly in its previous cases. I think that could be very helpful guidance for future reference. In this case, the defendant has shown no prejudice. It's all speculation. It would be helpful if that had occurred in this case, but for future reference.
It all depends on how many times you shout it from the mountain. Sooner or later, some cowherd down the mountain is going to hear it and do something about it. But it's frustrating to have a line of cases repeatedly emphasizing the importance of putting on the record what took place at a sidebar without a court reporter outside, presumably, the hearing of the jury. I think we all understand that there are circumstances that keep a trial moving where you don't want to, while the jury's in the jury room, you don't want to send them back to the jury room because you think it's going to be taken care of very quickly. You don't even want the court reporter to have to get out of her chair to move over to where she can take down what the parties are saying. But it's so easy to just say in one sentence what took place during the unrecorded sidebar so we don't have these kinds of issues.
And it would have been easy in this case for defense counsel to say, on a non-substantive issue, instead of without the court reporter. The state agrees, Your Honor.
On your third point, the question I have is, I understand the theory that the question of the state's witness about the earlier robbery was irrelevant if it were offered for some kind of evidence that this robbery did or didn't take place. But my understanding is it wasn't offered on that basis. It was offered solely to attack the credibility of the so-called victim, the prime state's witness, presumably, in any case of this kind. Now, how could a jury be confused, particularly with a proper limiting instruction, if it's clear that the only purpose for which the question is being asked is for the jury to test the credibility of Mr. Blackwell? How is that confusing?
Well, there are multiple reasons, Your Honor. First, that was a robbery. This was a robbery, burglary, shooting. Contrary to the record reflects that the victim was asked, were you robbed previously? He denied having ever been robbed previously. Defense counsel was able to ask Dia Coleman, his girlfriend, had you been robbed in December 2009, and she said no, which also, as a side note, shows that perhaps the information the defense counsel had may not have been as reliable. And then when he tried to go farther back in time was when the prosecutor objected and went to sidebar and raised the issue of relevance and confusion for the jury. So there is nothing, the defense counsel, when he questioned the victim, indicated that he had information that the other co-defendants had robbed this victim in the past. None of that came in through any of the other co-defendants. The defendant testified, I believe, that he thought the co-defendants had robbed this victim in the past. So it was never established that there was a past robbery. So in order, had the next question been asked to Dia Coleman, she says no, there's really nowhere else they can go unless they want to then have a trial within a trial about whether or not this prior robbery occurred. And furthermore, Dia Coleman, as his then-living girlfriend, now wife, if she had said there was a robbery, they still haven't established how they would have gotten over the hearsay rule, because they're not talking about a burglary. They're talking about a robbery, and I don't know how she would have had more evidence of a particular robbery that would have been admissible. It wouldn't have been admissible under 3507 because the victim denied that it ever happened, so they couldn't have laid that foundation. They made an argument in the reply brief that it would have been admitted as a hearsay exception, not for the truth of the matter, but under 3507. But if it's not admitted for the truth of the matter, it couldn't be used to impeach the victim's testimony. So it just seems that it would have led down a path of either Dia Campbell says no and the issue is over, or they attempt to have this trial within a trial about another robbery, confusing it with this robbery. It just seems
I guess my skepticism is, first, the trial judge didn't rule on the basis that 403 was impacted because it would necessitate a trial within a trial to determine the truth of whether that robbery Coleman might have testified to actually occurred, and that therefore Blackwell lied under oath. What the trial judge said was, I'm assuming since the trial judge went to 403 at all, that there's a concession there must be some relevance, but that relevance is overcome by the danger of the unfair prejudice in that the jury would be confused. What I'm struggling with is, how could the jury be confused? The question itself suggests it's a distinct robbery on a particular date, and it occurred in a circumstance where Mr. Blackwell was the victim, and Mr. Blackwell has said no, he'd never been robbed previously. End of story. It's not more complicated than that. The only argument that can be made from it is, Mr. Blackwell, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, wasn't telling you the truth on direct. How can you believe anything he said if he can't even honestly admit he'd been robbed previously? I don't know how anybody could be confused by that, particularly if there was any form of brief limiting instruction telling them the purpose for which they are hearing this is solely to impeach Mr. Blackwell's earlier testimony. If you believe Ms. Coleman, it may raise a question in your mind about the credibility of Mr. Blackwell's testimony. If, on the other hand, you believe Mr. Blackwell, whatever. But how is it confusing?
It's the state's position, and the trial court found that because this defendant was not on trial for that robbery, that it would have clouded the issue for the jury. And
well, did the trial judge say why?
No, I don't believe he did.
Yeah, what troubles me with 403, it's the catch-all for every trial judge that wants to overrule an objection. And when the trial judge doesn't explain the rational basis on which they find that there's confusion of the jury, require a trial within a trial, too much time is going to be involved, or any other basis for 403, it's like the invocation of an incantation in a religious ritual. I want to know what was the rational basis for a conclusion, one stated by the trial judge on the record, that a reasonable juror would have been confused by. this rather straightforward question.
I'm sorry.
No, wait, go ahead.
It appears from the record that the primary reason that it was, that the objection was sustained was based on relevance, that it just wasn't relevant to whether or not Wilmer Milton and these co-defendants robbed this victim at this time. And yeah, I understand.
Well, I think we probably all agree with that. But it, when do you say you cannot attack a witness's credibility because the basis on which you're going to attack it is not relevant to the facts of the crime for which a certain defendant is charged? Attacks on truthfulness and credibility are always admissible, aren't they? They're relevant for the purpose of impeaching the credibility of the witness who stated something to the contrary.
When the defendant was first asked about it, he denied it. We went through an entire trial where all of the co-defendants were there. None of them were asked about these prior robberies. And then to the defendant's girlfriend, and that would have been a very good place for defense counsel to have established the credibility of the victim being in question, to have asked one of the co-defendants that testified in the meantime.
Well, typically, though, good trial counsel doesn't ask questions of witnesses when he doesn't know what their answer will be. So it's hardly surprising that he didn't ask the question of co-defendants who were testifying against his client.
Actually, I stand corrected, Your Honor. Dia Coleman was in the next day, and the co-defendants came later. So I take back that prior argument. Your Honor, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. This court determines whether or not the trial court exceeded the bounds of reason in view of the circumstances or so ignored the rules of practice to produce injustice by limiting the cross-examination.
I understand that, and the bounds of reason resonates with me. That's why I want to know the rationale. I can't tell whether it's reasonable or not unless the trial judge tells me in the record why the trial judge believed that this would confuse the jury, because I can't see anything in the record that would confuse a juror.
If I could have a moment, Your Honor, I'm looking through the court's rationale. Mr. Donahue said, I don't see how it's relevant. This defendant is not on trial for that, after some discussion. And the court said, I'll sustain the objection. Any relevance is outweighed by the danger of confusion of the issues to the jury.
So the answer is the trial judge doesn't explain why he thought a juror would be confused.
It appears that he agreed throughout with Mr. Donahue's argument. That it was irrelevant. He objected on irrelevance grounds.
Okay.
Again, Your Honor, the standard review is abuse of discretion. The state does not believe that the Superior Court abused its discretion in limiting this cross-examination, for which is really based on a theory by defense counsel that has yet to be borne out in any evidence other than Wilmer Milton saying that he thought the co-defendants had robbed the victim in the past. Unless the court has further questions on those issues, on that particular issue, just say in sum that Mr. Milton has provided no basis for reversal. There was ample evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state, I believe his defense counsel conceded, that he intended to kill Blackwell. And that issue properly went to the jury. Mr. Milton has shown no prejudice from the unrecorded sidebars, which the state maintains defense counsel waived that issue by affirmatively requesting them be held off the record, and the third sidebar from the state was specifically stated that it was for a scheduling matter, which was non-substantive. And finally, the information sought from the victim girlfriend on cross-examination, the state maintains, was primarily irrelevant, but also would have confused the jury, and the Superior Court did not abuse its discretion in sustaining the state's objection.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.